Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, listener mail. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and boy, we've got a good mailbag for you today. I noticed, I think this is by pure coincidence, that today's batch of mail is just jammed with Dannys. We've got messages from Dans, Danielles, Dannys of all sorts, and as far as I can tell, they are all different people. So non-Dannys, you've got to step up your mail game. Don't let the Dannys have it all.
Wait, are you sure this isn't a mail robot error here? This sounds like exactly the kind of thing that could mean that there's some sort of underlying programming problem with our mailbot Carney. Perhaps he has now associated all listeners, all individuals who write in, with the name Dan.
Now, Carney, what have you got to say for yourself? Okay, we are assured that this is on the level.
Okay, good, because today's episode is also going to deal a lot with the idea of robot error and robot law.
Yeah, so jumping into responses to our pair of episodes on robot law, robot punishment, and all the questions that are probably going to be popping up in the near future about what happens when robots do wrong, let's jump right into this first message from Danny. Danny says, "Hi there. When thinking about how to best punish robots if they were ever to commit crimes, I thought about how people treat the character of Janet on the NBC show The Good Place. If you're not familiar, Janet is a near godlike AI that was created to help run an afterlife for humans. She looks like a normal person, but constantly reminds our main characters that she is not a person, but rather just a program written for the inhabitants of the afterlife to use. Some of the funniest parts of the show come when the human characters have to reboot Janet, but she is programmed to beg for her life to dissuade them from doing so. The closer they get to her reboot switch, the more she pleads with them to spare her life, all while also reminding them that she cannot in fact feel pain or emotions as she is just an AI. It raises a point that I think you touched on. Would it be cruel to program a robot or AI to feel pain as punishment? And even if we did program it to do so, would it actually be feeling pain? Or would we just be happy with the idea that we think the bad robot is feeling pain? I don't know, but I'm certain that The Good Place is hilarious and Janet is one of the best AIs ever created. Keep up the good work, Danny."
Yeah, the Good Place is a terrific show. Did you ever watch The Good Place, Joe?
Yeah, is it over now? If it is, we never actually got to the end of it, but we watched at least part of it and we liked it.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those rare shows that they went exactly four seasons, and it's, you know, pretty pitch perfect in my opinion. Like they got where they wanted to go, they closed mm-hmm. it out, terrific finish. And yeah, Janet, both good Janet, bad Janet, various other Janets that appear, they're all terrific, all played by Darcy Carden.
She's a
wonderful,
wonderful
American yeah. actress and comedian.
Jinx.
You can't jinx under a roof.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
That may be a regional rule in our house.
So thinking about whether robots would in fact be programmed to feel pain, I mean, so as we talked about in the episode, obviously I've got a lot of questions and skepticism about the underlying justification for punishments in general. I mean, I guess at bottom, my personal view of punishments would be partially utilitarian. Like if you could show that punishing people who harm other people actually does provide a significant deterrent that prevents them from doing harm to others in the first place, then I guess in some cases it would make sense, though then you'd also have to factor in the idea of individual rights, where like even, you know, so like if you're to go with a purely utilitarian idea of justice, you could probably find out that you could achieve overall good effects by doing like, you know, really unfair things to like one person in a case. So you'd have to avoid that kind of thing, too. But on the basic question, I guess I'm just skeptical about how good the evidence is that there is a strong deterrent effect across all types of cases for all types of crimes. I think it probably would actually vary a lot by type of crime and situation. For example, you can imagine a scenario where harsh punishments for harm caused by institutional actors, like the leaders of corporations or governments, might be more effective as direct deterrents than harsh punishments of individual behavior would be, but you know, that kind of thing. But I don't know what the actual evidence is or how strong it would be. But anyway, so directly addressing robots, assuming it is true that punishments are sometimes effective as a deterrent that prevents a significant amount of harm from happening in the first place, in the case of biological offenders like us, it's just an a priori assumption that disincentives have to come in the form of suffering, right? We sort of alluded to this in the episode because we inherently desire not to have to, I don't know, pay somebody a huge sum of money when it's found that we hurt them or spend time in jail or something like that. We don't want to face those outcomes because those outcomes will cause us to suffer and we're inherently motivated not to suffer. But robots don't have inherent motivations. They're motivated by whatever they're programmed to be motivated by. So the equation of deterrence with suffering as a natural component of it, to whatever extent and in whichever cases that is actually effective, it's contingent on the offenders being biological with inherent motivations against suffering. Robots could be deterred by things that are not really painful to them in any way that we would understand pain. They're just motivated by whatever they're told to be motivated by.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you could program them to desire pain, to desire suffering, and to want to share suffering with everyone, and to make sure that all beings attain maximum suffering. Again, this was a fascinating topic to talk about, just because of all the little nooks and crannies you find yourself in, contemplating both the human condition and the idea of creating something comparable to the human condition in machines.
But anyway, Danny, I think you raise good questions and they can connect back to a lot of the things we were talking about. You can imagine even people desiring robots that simulate pain, like you're talking about, just to give people the psychic satisfaction of seeing them punished when they do wrong or something like that. When mm-hmm. really the thing that if you're like trying to rationally minimize harm, what would be important would not be the robot feeling pain, but them being reprogrammed in a way that so that they don't behave like that in the future, or other robots of their same kind don't behave that way in the future.
Yeah.
Anyway, Rob, do you want to look at this next message from Robin?
Yes. Robin writes, "Hi, Rob, Joe, and Seth. In the Punish the Machine Part 2 podcast, Rob mentioned a thought experiment about an AI train system that accidentally killed a bunch of people by not having oxygen ready for the arrival. You could not remember where this particular story came from." This is true. I could not remember. I was actually looking it up during or prior to the episode, and I was thinking, maybe it's Max Tegmark, and I was looking around for it, and then I did a search or two, and I just could not for the life of me remember where I picked this up. But I was thinking nonfiction, but Robin straightens me out. Quote, the anecdote you are remembering is from the Rifters series by Peter Watts. Oh. I believe it was in the first book, Starfish. The smart gel, or head cheese as they call it, was using a clock to learn when to turn on the oxygen, and the clock broke. There is some delicious AI shenanigans speculation in those books. And yes, true enough, this is exactly where, once she pointed it out, I'm like, yep, I remember that totally. Because, yeah, these neural nets, these smart gels or head cheeses, they do play a major role in the plot. And there's a lot of consideration about how they could make ultimately catastrophic decisions that were from their vantage point, the best way to solve given problems.
This makes so much sense, thinking about Peter Watts' fiction. A lot of what Peter Watts does is create genuine horror scenarios where the horror is derived from a failure of human imagination to comprehend other types of cognition and reasoning. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of cosmic horror that comes from the human inability to understand what it's like to think as an alien, or the human inability to understand what it's like to think as an AI.
Yeah, yeah. So definitely, yeah, Peter Watts, look up his work if you're interested. We're big fans. I read Starfish and a couple of the books and Rifters that followed that. And then what was Blindsight was the other one, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a very scary alien contact novel. And we've read some of his short stories. We talked about one that deals with religious technology that was very good and very scary.
Yeah, yeah. So, look him up. Great, some good reads there. Can get a bit, you know, for some taste, it may get a little heady and a little dark, though I think Watts would argue that the futures that he creates are in many ways less dark than the realities that we find ourselves in today. So consider that as you peruse his work.
Yeah, I would say overall just really good cerebral horror sci-fi.
All right, Robin has more, though. Robin says, as a side note, I would like to thank you folks for doing the crossover episode with Seth. It got me to look up the Spotify playlist for Record Store Society, which led me to discover the artist Do Make Say Think. They are fabulous to listen to as I work. I'm slowly working through that Spotify playlist, and I am rediscovering old and discovering new music that I enjoy. So thanks to Seth and to you folks for the musical education. Cheers, Robin.
Oh, I'll love to hear that.
Yeah, absolutely. We did a couple of crossovers with Seth. We did a Weird House Cinema where he came on the show and we talked about weird music videos. And then we went on to Record Store Society and talked about just music, cool music videos in general. Hopefully that led a number of people to discover Record Store Society and even, you know, discover some new music. That's awesome.
Totally. And if you haven't checked it out yet, you can look them up. They're just a few weeks back in our feed now. And of course, you can find Record Store Society wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, this next message comes from Kenneth. Kenneth says, hi, Rob and Joe. Thanks for reading out my last email. Kenneth, I honestly don't remember which one that was. But Kenneth says, though if I'd known it would make it on air, I would have waffled a lot less. Again, don't know what that's referring to. I loved the recent series of AI-themed episodes, and as you discussed what might be an appropriate sanction for a wayward robot, it immediately put me in mind of Red Dwarf, the UK comedy/sci-fi show. In one episode, Crichton, I hope I'm saying that right, I've never seen this show, the crew's outdated mechanoid is replaced by Hudson 10, the perfect machine. Unfortunately, in the millions of years he's spent waiting to be delivered, his sanity chip has worn out and he goes on a rampage. He's eventually defeated in an homage to Captain Kirk murdering supercomputers with paradoxes when Crichton tells him that Silicon Heaven doesn't exist. Hudson asks, but where do all the little calculators go? To which Crichton replies, they just die. Hudson then expires in a kind of does not compute, buzzed kind of way. This got me thinking that perhaps positive reinforcement is the way to go with our future robotic companions. If they are programmed for a given task, they could be given rewards of energy, upgrades, repairs, etc. If they were good little robots. It's very transactional, but I could imagine them striving for rewards that will make them more efficient. I also really enjoyed the episodes about extraterrestrial machine intelligences, but I did want to defend the humans and drones of Ian M. Banks' culture. They aren't just parasites or pets. They are an essential part of the good works the culture undertakes. Interfering to improve other civilizations is what it considers its moral right to exist, and the humans and drones are pretty central to that. I like the idea of ultra-intelligent minds using their power to make the universe a better place, and Banks' optimistic take on AI was always one I found very engaging. On a complete tangent, future episodes discussing megastructures such as Niven rings, Banks orbitals, or O'Neill's cylinders would be absolutely fascinating. Keep up the great work, Kenneth.
Well, I have not seen Red Dwarf either, but I know that's a show that's much beloved by many science fiction fans. On the culture note, I don't remember. Did I argue that they were parasites or pets? I don't know.
We might have made an offhand comparison that maybe we weren't being super serious about.
Maybe the confusion. I might have said something meaning, or I might have meant to state that it's kind of like the opposite. Like the culture is essentially machines. It's essentially the minds, but the humans. You could almost see them as pets at this point. You could almost, I wouldn't call them parasites per se, but they're this thing that is kept alive by the minds of the culture because that is, you know, part of what they do. It's part of their whole existence and mission. Anyway, I mean, ultimately, this is all expressed in the culture books far better than I can just summarize here. But he did indeed have this wonderful optimistic view of super intelligent machines, but with plenty of complications that make, you know, novels of adventure and discovery worthwhile.
So they may be sort of the culture's reason for existing, even if they're not really calling the shots within the culture.
Right.
Which is funny because in that way, I think they could possibly be compared to consciousness within humans, right? Yeah. So your consciousness is the reason to get out of bed in the morning. Like your conscious experience is the reason to keep living and keep doing anything. But of course, a lot of the decisions you make and actions you perform, while you might have the illusion that they're driven by conscious processes, you can actually show that at least in a lot of cases, maybe in every case, maybe not in every case, it, you know, can't know for sure, but at least in a lot of cases, decisions about what your body does are happening sort of upstream of consciousness, and you're just sort of having the illusion that, like, yeah, I did that with my conscious brain.
Yeah, I should also point out that in the culture books, you'll often have long stretches where it's just one mind talking to another, one AI talking to another AI, or multiple AIs having a conversation about what's happening or what's going to happen. And those can be quite amusing, in part because they all have kind of ridiculous, drawn-out names for each other, and they all have different personalities and different factions.
We actually didn't ask. So we were talking in the Machine Lords of Barnard 68 episodes about whether post-biological superintelligences would have something that we would recognize as emotions. And you kind of have to think if they have personalities, then maybe they would have something that we recognize as emotions. Do the AIs in the culture series by Banks have emotions?
Yeah, they seem to. I mean, it gets kind of complicated. You know, if a machine is capable of seeming like it has emotions and realizes there's an advantage in portraying emotions, then it is, sometimes it's hard to differentiate that between genuine emotions, or maybe there is no difference. And I can't recall, this very question may have come up at some point in the culture books and I just don't remember it, but they seem to have personalities and emotions. I think some are a bit more temperamental and bristly than others, and others are, a bit eccentric. So I would say so. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray.
Astepro delivers full prescription strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. Astepro Allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
All right, the next one comes to us from Joe, different Joe. Joe, yes. Writes, I really enjoyed your two-parter on law enforcement applied to autonomous intelligences. There were some wonderful explorations of how this relates to enforcing the law against corporate persons. There is another parallel path where we as a society had to struggle with how to enforce the law while also reckoning with a growing understanding of how the perpetrators are not motivated by what we expect, not using the same processes to make decisions, and not as fundamentally culpable as we imagine. Juvenile law enforcement. I've been lucky enough to serve in a policymaking capacity as part of a state juvenile justice agency and have seen firsthand the benefits of this better informed approach. As everyone who has had a toddler can confirm, children are capable of tremendous destruction. And as they get older, they can do and say terrible and harmful things that have all the appearance of conscious and informed choice. However, as we've learned more about child brain development, we are moving towards restorative and corrective models of juvenile justice rather than the retributive and punitive systems that have been dominant throughout history. As you have covered on other episodes, we are beginning to suspect that human brains, and especially juvenile brains, often provide illusory surface-level rationales for actions that are actually controlled by obscure, deep-seated processes that more closely resemble machine learning than we care to admit. We've started to incorporate those lessons into how we handle children who commit otherwise criminal offenses and have begun reaping the rewards of healthier and safer communities. I'm optimistic that we will apply that wisdom to correcting the mistakes of artificial intelligence moving forward, rather than seeking the primal gratification of knowing some being has suffered as a consequence of our misfortune. I even dare to hope that we will someday learn to apply those lessons to adult human minds, which are often much less authentically culpable for the harm they cause than we imagine. Joe.
Oh, interesting to hear from somebody who's involved in this field. Yeah, getting into juvenile criminal justice and all that, I know that's got to be a really just difficult area, even, you know, people motivated with the best of intentions. It's good to hear from somebody who's got firsthand experience.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, here's another one for us, Joe. Why don't you hit this one? This one looks like it's a question about the music.
Here's another one from Dan Kind. This one comes from Danielle. Danielle says, "Hi, was wondering if you could tell me the name of the music that plays during the Artifact episodes." Thank you, Danielle. That's it. Well, I had to check with Seth about this. This was not one of the pieces that I created. This was one that Seth got from one of the deep libraries of stock music that we have access to here at iHeartMedia. And so he dug up the meta. This track is by an artist named Josh Heinemann. It is called Creeping In, which we found very funny when he revealed that to us earlier. And it's from an album called Reality Game Show 2. And so you can look that up if you like. But yeah, it seems like he sourced it from a library of stock music that's common for, you know, producers to use to create beds underneath the talking in all of your favorite podcasts.
Yeah, it's a looping track, so that it doesn't matter how long the Artifact episode goes. Yeah, and some of those databases can be pretty neat. I remember looking around in one a while back and noticing that there was at least like one collection of sounds that had been created by Alan Howarth, who of course is known for his musical collaborations with director John Carpenter on helping to create some of the most iconic John Carpenter movie film scores.
Chariots of Pumpkins, man.
Yeah, great track.
Also, for our amusement, Seth supplied the keywords that go along with this track. So it's slow tempo, subtle to neutral tension, underscore, drone, bed, ethereal, electronic, electronica, soundtrack score, pulsing synth pad, pulsing synth bass, light lo-fi perk loop, ethereal synth pads, reverse guitar, subtle to neutral tension. I think it already said that. Underscore, and it looks like it's just looping now, which is appropriate for a looping track.
All right, here's another one. This one comes to us from Jeremy. Hello, Joe and Robert. Your recent Fault episodes about Medusa's head and Weird House episodes about detached heads living on reminded me of the detachable head of the Queen of the Moon, played by Valentina Cortez opposite Robin Williams. Or is that Cortez or Cortez?
Cortese?
Cortese?
I'm not familiar with this actor.
Yeah. Anyway, quote, which has an independent life in the classic epic, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. Although it in no way counts as a B-movie, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen may well contain enough weirdness for a Weird House episode. Many thanks for the hours of intelligent entertainment. Best regards, and Jeremy.
Hey, that's Terry Gilliam.
Yeah, Terry Gilliam is always potentially, it's anything he creates, I would say, is potentially weird enough for Weird House cinema, no matter how much money he had to play with in creating it.
Uh-huh. Where are you on Gilliam, Rob? Because I've got a theory that nobody is tepid on Terry Gilliam's post-Monty Python movies. People either love them or absolutely hate them. And I think Gilliam's aesthetics can be kind of challenging sometimes, but I love the Terry Gilliam movies.
Yeah, I haven't sat down and watched a Terry Gilliam movie in quite a spell here at this point, but I can say that I love Terry Gilliam movies, or I love to like them. I think some of the more recent ones, I maybe haven't loved them as much, but there's always something to love in them. You know, there's an authentic weirdness, an authentic Terry Gilliam vibe to them, where there's something to latch on to there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I haven't seen all of his more recent movies, but I'm thinking back at least to the earlier post-Python movies like Time Bandits, Brazil, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. Did he do 12 Monkeys? I think we were just talking about
12 Monkeys, yeah. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a bunch of good ones.
I think we were talking about Brazil on the show not too long ago because of some other scene in a movie where there were just random ducts go all yep. over the place. And that's the thing I always think about with Brazil is just a absolutely genius visual representation of the themes of the movie. Like every room is just crammed full of ducts and you have no idea why they're there or what they're taking from one place to the other.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Brazil is an excellent movie. And Baron Munchausen, which I may have seen more recently than other of his films, which means I saw it at some point in the last 10 years, is a lot of fun. It's just got such some rich old-fashioned fantasy going on in it.
Yeah, it's been a long time for me, but I remember feeling the same. Okay, you ready to move on to this next one? I can do this message from Jimmy that is about robot punishment and Weird House Cinema.
Go for it.
Okay, Jimmy says, "Hey guys, I love your show. Just started listening to it and have been really digging the topics. I got pulled in with the episode on locks, and I knew I was going to be a permanent listener when I saw you had an episode on Gunhead. As a huge fan of weird movies and D&D, which you guys have mentioned several times, I knew it was fate that brought your show to my attention. That and
I have to jump in here, Joe. I feel like doing an episode on Gunhead is the kind of thing where you would almost expect someone in the company to be like, "Hey guys, what are you doing? Doing an episode on Gunhead?"
Uh-huh.
And now we can legitimately respond with, "We are earning permanent listeners,
right? Yes,
by doing episodes on Gunhead. Otherwise, how would we bring people in?"
But that's like every episode we do. It'd be kind of hard to explain to the business division why this episode on Spoons, why this episode on Gunhead.
Yeah.
So we say, "You're just going to have to trust us." Anyway, Jimmy goes on. "In the episode Punish the Machine, you talked about how we react negatively to the seeming, quote, behavior of inanimate objects, often blaming them for transgressions or failures. Being a fan of D&D, I immediately thought of dice shaming, dice jails, and the acts a player might perform when their dice roll poorly from the aforementioned examples, to throwing dice, banishing them back into the bag, admonishing the die verbally, or deciding that a particular D20 has, quote, used up its good rolls for the session and is now useless. I kept hoping it would be mentioned in the episode."
I think it did come to mind when we were doing it, and I just ended up not bringing it up because I was thinking about I've never actually punished dice before, but I know I've spoken with people who have or know people that have, you know, that the dice wasn't performing properly. It would be shamed or put away or even discarded. I think the closest thing for me is that for a long time I had two different D20s in my bag of dice. One was a black D20 that matched the rest of my dice, and the other one was like this random kind of amber-colored D20, and I have no idea where it came from. But for some reason or another, for a while I was using both of them, and it seemed like the brown dice was the brown D20 was outperforming the black one, and so I ended up just sticking with the brown one.
Yeah.
And eventually, I think I gave the black one away to a child so that they could play D&D.
May you absorb the cursed luck of this item.
Yeah, which is, of course, it's all ridiculous because these are exactly the same. There's no difference. They're not, you know, weighted differently. They don't have different energies, et cetera. And I'm not even particularly, I mean, aesthetically, I would have to say I would prefer the one that matches the rest of my set. But no, the brown one was performing better, so that's the one I kept.
This is funny because I was just playing D&D last night. Actually, we were talking before we started recording that we both played D&D virtually last night. And so the character I'm playing right now is a rogue. If you're not familiar with D&D, he's got low constitution, low armor class. So it means like, you know, a couple of bad rolls and you're very low. You're very close to death.
Yeah.
And one of the closest calls of my campaign right now was literally from repeatedly rolling a one to check my ability at walking up a hill in the snow. and so the dice can really do you dirty and you can get mad at them.
Yeah, yeah. Get another character to help you next time, and then you'll get an advantage on that roll, Joe.
To help me walking.
Yes. Help an old man up the hill.
Anyway, we should go on with Jimmy's message. Jimmy picks up, "However, the thing that compelled me to write in was your Weird House Cinema episode on frogs, which I really enjoyed. Your prompt for other Nature in Revolt movies was a call to action, as I immediately thought of Phase 4, a film in which a couple of scientists study a group of strangely behaving ants that are plaguing the countryside and building bizarre hives. It gets very out there with concepts and features some really awesome and also horrifying scenes of ants. It's definitely weird, and whether or not you feature it in an episode, it is certainly worth a watch. A second suggestion for a uniquely bizarre film is The Visitor." I know this one.
Yeah, me too.
"A truly strange film about cosmic entities in a struggle of good versus evil. Throw in killer birds, trippy art house cinema visuals, a girl with mental powers, and it turns into a heck of a ride. It's got Lance Henriksen, Glenn Ford, John Huston, and a cameo by Franco Nero as Space Jesus. Anyway, I am truly enjoying your show and can't wait to dig through the back catalog. Keep up the great work. Thank you for your time, Jimmy." Well, thanks for this message, Jimmy. And oh, yeah, we've seen The Visitor. You may not know this, but we, of course, live in the Atlanta area. And The Visitor was filmed in Atlanta in the 70s or 80s. I think the 70s. And so we like there are recognizable roads and landmarks in it. But it is also just it is so odd. It has a kind of spaghetti Western thing going on, which is and by that, I mean, like it's an Italian film filmed in the United States with primarily U.S. actors. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain there's a certain shadow quality to it that is very engrossing and very alienating at the same time.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Though a lot of the fun I had with it was just the fact that it was filmed in Atlanta back in the day, so you can see various landmarks of Atlanta there. It doesn't hide its Atlantaness, and its Atlantaness is not subtle. So it's not like Free Jack where they're filming it in Atlanta, pretending it's something else, mm-hmm. And you have to look closely to catch it. No, it's very Atlanta. As for Phase 4, I haven't seen this one. I'm vaguely aware of it because it's kind of late for a giant ant movie in cinematic history. But I'd be interested to check it out.
Is it giant ants? I thought it was normal-sized ants.
Is it normal ants?
Well, I haven't seen it, so maybe we'll have to find out.
The ant looks big on the poster. But then again, the frog looks big on the poster for frogs. So it could be the same marketing gimmick where it's like, we can't put a normal-sized frog on this poster. It needs to be huge, and there needs to be a person's arm sticking out of it. If we're going to put an ant on this poster, it needs to be larger than a human hand.
I think that's very plausible.
All right, here's another one. You want to take this one, Joe, from Brandon?
Sure. Brandon says, "Hi, guys. I have a suggestion for Weird House Cinema. One of my all-time favorites, Shockma. It is a 90s B-movie about a genetically altered baboon that terrorizes a group of med students that are LARPing D&D. Also, it has Roddy McDowell. I think you would like this odd treat. Keep up the great work, Brandon." I don't remember much about this movie, but I did watch part of it long ago at a friend's house, and it was, at least from the parts I saw, the best killer baboon bottle episode movie I have ever seen.
The trailer for it is amazing. So see the trailer, if nothing else, because the trailer has this wonderful, intense narration that gets more intense, and it keeps saying, "Shockma, Shockma," till at the very end, the baboon leaps at the camera, and the narrator just goes, "Shockma," and then it ends.
I think Shockma is the baboon's name.
I think so, yeah, yeah. And of course, this is also like this is the sort of trailer where they just say the name of the film so many times. And I miss that. Like, I wish they did that more.
Yeah. Gabo, Gabo, Gabo. Rob, do you want to read our last transmission from Planet Daniel?
Yes. All right. Daniel writes, "Hey, all, just listened to the Mad Love episode and wanted to add to the voices in support of all of your amazing dives into these curious and overlooked films. The Weird House Cinema episodes are a great source of education." Well, okay. "And entertainment." I guess they are educational in their own way.
Sometimes.
I miss visiting art house theaters and peeping whatever strange film they've unearthed and are eager to share. Your podcast brings a similar sense of wonder, so for that, I'm very appreciative. Thank you, and keep doing amazing work. Daniel.
Oh, too kind, Daniel. Well, thank you, and thanks for writing in. Okay, should we wrap it up there?
I guess so, yeah. We generally, once we get into the weird houses, we're done. I think we're out of time, but we thank everybody for writing in. You know, if we just bear in mind, you know, we don't always get to respond to email. We rarely get to respond to email, and we only get to read some of it on here, despite the weekly format. But we do read in our own head silently, or maybe sometimes mumbling out loud. I don't know, but we do read it all. So, if you write into us, we will read it. We will try and respond if we have time, or we will, you know, if we'll try and feature some of it on the listener mail. But just keep it coming, because it's great to know what everybody else out there is thinking, what your own expertise or experience says about a given topic, and also it's a great place to make suggestions for the future. So keep it coming.
Should we tell you to hold off for a couple weeks if your name is any variation on Dan? Is that
no? Don't limit the Dans. Okay. Let unleash the Dans.
Okay.
Keep it up, Dans.
Dans, Dannies, Danielles, Daniels. Just come on in.
Yep.
Anyway, huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway the great American race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network.